Welcome to the Think Data podcast, brought to you in partnership with Dataworks. If you want to stay up to date with the latest breakthroughs and trends in the world of data and artificial intelligence, and if you're curious about some of the strategies that companies and founders use to launch data and AI products, then you're in the right place. Our aim is to bring together a diverse lineup of fantastic guests, from the founders through to accomplished leaders and product owners at some of the most fascinating data and AI companies worldwide. They will each offer you their own unique insight into what it takes to launch and scale a great data business. Thanks for tuning in, and I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to the Think Data podcast in partnership with Dataworks. On today's show, I'm really excited to welcome Jeff Elton. He is the CEO of Concert AI. They are a global leader within clinical AI and real-world data solutions. Jeff has a wealth of experience in the life sciences and health space, which has seen him work for the likes of Accenture, Novartis, McKinsey, and as a lecturer at Boston University. Yeah, it's really good to have you on, Jeff. I know we talked kind of offline about the work that you've been doing in this space, but equally our experience in this space. And I was really interested because you've been at Concert, what, 6.5, nearly 7 years now?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so in terms of your backstory and what led you to be the CEO, because you have obviously had that kind of quintessentially, you had that kind of management strategy consulting background. Yeah. You've then worked within education. You've then worked as a startup prior to this. So yeah, I was interested to dig on that. What, how did you come to be here?
Yeah. So I've always stayed very close to biomedical or healthcare innovations. So I think one, the nature of what we do attracted me to the opportunity, no question. I have a history, a little bit as you went back and forth, I have a history working for larger organizations like a McKinsey or a Novartis, but then I also have a history of doing startup entities and some of those taking them all the way through to either, you know, IPO, exit, et cetera. So sometimes you need to make progress. It's easier in an entrepreneurial context. Sometimes it's easier if you've got the resources of a large incumbent organization. But Concert AI itself was very unusual because I've done a lot of work in oncology. It had a relationship with the American Society of Clinical Oncology from the beginning. That was put into place at the very tail end of 2017. I also knew ASCO from my time at Accenture, so I had a very deep commitment and knowledge of them. The original investors also had targeted an entity that was called Vector Oncology, that was an oncology real-world data group that I'd also known for 5 to 6 years. So there were a set of foundational elements that actually they and we and I were well-suited for each other, if you will. And I have to admit, the world of oncology, I just find so compelling, this notion that you've got high unmet medical need. There's no question why you're doing what you're doing. The second part is you have data. It's one of the few clinical areas that because of the war on cancer, the work that the National Cancer Institute's in different areas, you have more data about patients in oncology than you almost do in any other disease category. Now that'll start to shift and change with AI coming into health systems and different ways of capturing that. So for me, as somebody that has always been at this intersection of new methodologies, I was actually doing work in AI and other approaches at Accenture. The ability to kind of come into an area like oncology was compelling in itself. So
interesting. And to people who are listening to this, who aren't that au fait with obviously real world data and clinical AI, you know, and specifically related to content, what does that mean in practice and kind of what problem are you solving?
Yeah, great question. So, and thanks, Alex. Sometimes I walk in my own field and we're a very narrow specific field. So sometimes it's good to kind of have that notion and kind of come back and kind of say, so real world data really means data that's produced in the context of delivering care. So it either could be data that's in the electronic medical record environment, could be medical claims. It could be genomic data that's captured in a next generation sequencing test. It could be a digital pathology image. It could be a radiological image. So it's all those different data types that are kind of brought together. Now in healthcare and oncology specifically, 80% of that data actually is what's called kind of unstructured or not machine readable. That actually means that you, even if you're in an EMR or something else, I can't ask the machine to analyze or perform a calculation or glean an insight because it's not machine readable. It's a PDF, it's some other form that actually requires different tools. So that's why humans, when they're actually in particular oncology, they have to go on, click on tabs and go through documents, reread notes, go back and look at the radiologist interpretation report. So the first thing we do is make sure that all that non-machine readable data can now be read by machines, because otherwise I can't glean patterns and I can't know who's responding or non-responding to a particular medicine or therapeutic approach unless we bring that forward, because almost all of response is in that unstructured data. So that's always been one of the big barriers. And that's probably one of the areas that we have probably not the, well, we probably have the deepest competence for actually advancing that, and one of the largest scales that then allows us to look at even very rare disease states and get some meaningful insights around them.
Interesting. You obviously joined 6.5 years back, and you, as you said, there was a connection. You obviously knew the guys, and you know it was kind of it seemed like the right match. In terms of you joining, what were some of the first challenges you had to overcome over those over kind of the initial months and years? And if you looked back now, you know, how do you describe that journey?
Kind of an appropriate question as we're closing 24 and thinking about the beginning of 25. Yeah. You know, it's always, you know, it's a field. And Alex, it's kind of a nuanced question too, because we're in a field that is evolving very rapidly. And things we could do today, we couldn't do then. So I'll try to separate a little bit between what we learned and if we had known it, we could have done it then, versus what we've learned and recognize what technology allows us to do today that we were never able to do before. So when we set up the company, everything in oncology and oncology research was very small scale and very bespoke. And so you had a question, you'd assemble a unique data set to that question. Oftentimes the data model, not to get too technically specific, was very unique to the study as opposed to a broader based, you know, OMOP or generally accepted data model that others could kind of operate under. And so everything was very study based, and it was a series of high expertise projects. When we set up the company, we wanted to make more progress more quickly. In fact, in the first presentations we even made at investor conferences, we kind of said, you know, it actually took about 50 years to reduce cancer deaths on a percentage basis, 20 to 30%. And so we're like, okay, 20 to 30% is significant. 50 years is too long. Yeah. If we kind of indicated we wanted to kind of half that time or do, you know, kind of almost an order of magnitude improvement in what those outcomes, what would that take? Well, what that would take is larger scale data, more immediately available, lower latency, meaning much more accurate, much more contemporaneous to the actual treatment, and providing that data to more researchers such that more insights could be gleaned with higher confidence off those larger data sets. That was really hard. So we did say that from the beginning, and that also was part of our business model, which is instead of this being more of a consulting high expertise research group, we were trying to move towards data as a service, software as a service, raise the level of play, raise the precision of what we were doing, but also go to a high reoccurring revenue basis that kind of constantly brought to the community solutions that improved all the time, because as the community used it, it would naturally improve off that same sort of concept of software as a service or things of that nature, that everybody gets the same benefits of each of the innovations and things of that nature that comes from those customers. That took us about 9 months to kind of work our way through and get the first element. So while we started end of 17, early 18, it wasn't until September of 19 that we were actually able to deliver some of the first data sets that embodied those particular characteristics. And that involved human effort. We actually, at that point, we have hundreds of high expertise human beings in specialty environments using special tools to do that work. Wow. Now, fast forward to today, and you know, the world of large language models is on everybody's vocabulary, and you call it a generative AI, open AI, Anthropic, whatever you want. So when we can do work today, we can use a series of large language models tuned to oncology, and we use agents. So what we learn from the human approaches is, how do you do this work? And the power of an agent, an agentic AI, which sometimes it's called, is that if I really understand that deeply, I can create different tools in the form of an agent that can actually interplay with those large language models to actually start doing things at a much faster rate and a much larger scale. In fact, we're challenging ourselves now by going up an order of magnitude again in terms of kind of the nature of what we can kind of do. So it's been a lot. I think, you know, we're finding we probably could have deployed natural language processing tools a lot earlier. We ended up building our own, and our own were actually much more accurate on ecology concepts than things you could get that were kind of the open source general ones or from the cloud providers. So I think, you know, looking backwards, we probably would have put more effort against that if we ever would have anticipated the nature of how AI would go forward. And we've been an AI company since our formation, but the latest generation of technologies are so much more powerful and can contextualize the data and the information they're reading such that the accuracy of how they extract concepts is beyond what we were able to do before with just pure natural language processing, where we had to direct them and actually do very careful orchestrated utilization and review processes and things of that nature. So, you know, you look back and you do have the advantage of that. But I think we could have pushed a little bit harder at the time. And I think now we're understanding what we're doing and actually pushing a lot harder.
Yeah, it's interesting. The rate at which AI has kind of accelerated this, certainly healthcare and obviously the research side of things, it can do things, certainly the NLP side can do things far quicker than the human eye. And actually at the moment, because you're training those models, it means that, is that effectively freeing up? So if you're looking at kind of a researcher, for example, this is just giving them a better, they can cover more ground, I'm guessing.
Yeah, and I like the way you asked the question, Alex, because you kept the human in the loop.
Yeah.
And I want to, and I think maybe if you kind of allow me to make a little kind of a little side commentary on that, because everything we do, if you think about what does Concert AI do, we advance data sets that then go into peer-reviewed journals. They need to have high veracity, confidence in the analysis and the results. That's why we put them in a peer review area. These publications oftentimes advance, whether they're in hematological malignancies, solid tumors, et cetera. They receive consideration from provider communities, medical societies, and it becomes kind of ultimately evidence or things that can begin to change how patients are treated. That's what we're trying to do. Mm-hmm. We're trying to kind of advance things that have that level of confidence and utility behind them. That means whatever we're doing is augmenting the humans. We're actually trying to make the high expertise humans that know their domain that much more productive.
Yep.
And that means we have to give them tools that they can have confidence in that kind of does it. So everything we do always has a human in that particular loop, human in review, human is the final point of decision-making, transparency, even how models work. And again, part of the world of large language models, and it's part of the debate that regulatory bodies, US FDA in particular, is if I don't know how the model was built, can I trust its outcomes? And also knowing models learn. So they evolve and they're dynamic in certain characteristics. So part of your assurance here is keeping that human in the loop and how you keep that human in the loop as you're doing that process. So
you touched on a really interesting point, because I think there's so much nervousness, uncertainty from the consumer side or about AI within health. And I think from a research standpoint, certainly we look at oncology, hematology, I think you're looking at things where you're trusting the model, but equally, if you flip it on its head, you normally would be trusting the human. So when you're looking at these working in a symbiotic kind of relationship, are we kind of creating the perfect scenario here where you've got obviously someone's overlooking it all, who's the expert, but they're actually looking at data sets that's also being created by a model that's already trained on their data anyway?
Yeah. Great question again. So just so that people kind of have an understanding of like who I am personally, I don't flip the on switch on every single aspect of AI in my personal life.
Yeah.
So, because if it's a generic solution that's operating in a untuned, unconstrained, publicly available stack, et cetera, I have my own personal kind of, you know, if you will, kind of watch over that and kind of surveillance on that. in the work we do, and it's being done in very narrow, specific contexts. We use concepts called anchoring, so that when a model starts doing, you actually kind of pin it down and say, always start here, so that you're actually controlling the accuracy, surveillance of the accuracy, and you're kind of pulling that human into it. The importance about the work we do in healthcare and oncology specifically, if you interviewed medical oncologists today, there's fewer graduating from med school. The number of patients they're taking care of is actually going up. So their need to have confidence that they're making the right decisions is actually kind of, they need tools like this. Mm-hmm. So they're putting the time in to make sure that we can mature them such that they have the confidence in them that they can kind of deploy them. Radiological imaging, same thing. Radiologists have always been known because they're tech-centric by nature of the work that they do. But there's fewer radiologists graduating from medical school, but there's actually an increase in imaging, and imaging requirements is kind of coming forward. So you take some of these clinical disciplines where they actually want AI to become an integral part of their particular workflows. That doesn't mean that they're not putting a, you know, kind of a, both a combination of a critical eye towards how is it built? What does it do? And how do I know I can have the confidence in it? But they're also kind of indicating these are going to be part of how we work and how we operate. So when we're in this particular community, we have super high engagement with the ultimate end users. They ask all the tough questions. We try to make sure we have huge transparency in how we evolve things. We actually publish everything in this area too. So at the last American Society of Clinical Oncology meeting, we published all the major models in our clinical trial solutions. And in fact, we will be at the NVIDIA GTC25 meeting coming up next year. And we'll be publishing everything we do there too. So we try to make sure that this is high trust, that AI that's being deployed for really very worthy reasons that we actually need it to do.
100%. Yeah, I think the R&D piece is where we've seen this, you know, huge acceleration of innovation, and that will only improve. And I'm interested to touch on kind of how does it not only feel, but what does it mean to be in charge of the world's largest kind of hematology and oncology data set? Because obviously you've got all this, you know, this data at your disposal, and as you said, you're regularly contributing to all of the publications, all the journals. Yeah. What does it mean in practice?
Right. So, you know, we do, to your last point, we have hundreds of publications that go into peer-reviewed journals or abstracts and presented at medical societies. The American Society of Hematology was just a week and a half ago, and, you know, we had several things there that we had positioned there and advanced. So first and foremost, we feel the privilege that the healthcare providers that we kind of work with have given to us. We have very specific agreements in place. It actually outlines the type of work and research that we do, and also outlines things we don't do with data. So we do view ourselves as being kind of privileged stewards of really very unusual data. And as privileged stewards, it doesn't mean I'm a very strong believer that data that actually is not used and doesn't generate insights really doesn't have value. And so our job really is to make sure that we are taking that scale and that scope, asking probably some of the rigorous, most difficult to address questions, actually going after cancers that have proven resistant to current treatment, understand why is that resistance. That's why we actually have exome and transcriptomes to kind of get into that and understand where did that resistance get acquired, because ostensibly the patient looks like they should be responsive to that. So it's actually both a combination of the nature of how we use, the nature of the questions we address it, the speed with which we try to operate on that. So for us, it kind of comes with, it's a responsibility, but it opens up the aperture of classes of problems we can go after that without that scale, you wouldn't be able to go after, because cancer is hundreds of diseases. It drops down, you know, the classic funnel. I ask a high level question, and then by the time I work my day, I'm on a very narrow question. I mean, you're probably just the nature of what you do, even being called think data. Data tends to perform that way. That by the time you work your way down, you're down to a very small group. You really want that small group to still be highly representative and generalizable to the total population that then may become a beneficiaries of the insight or the medicine or the innovation or whatever it is at the end of the day. And that's how we kind of think about what we're doing. It's not large to be large. It's large to actually have higher value and to be able to go after the most catastrophic diseases with confidence.
Yeah, I think that's, it's a really nice point, because I think people are all for reducing the, you know, the cancer rates or in improving the cancer treatment rates. So actually, but it's also, there's a lot of trust being placed in organizations like yourself with the data and what's being held of them. And I'm keen to touch on it, because we've seen a big rise in clinical cloud. We've seen a lot of organizations, not so much just like Concert, but companies holding personal data, you know, real world data, healthcare data. What are some of the considerations other leaders should be aware of? Because there is a big push on this, but equally that comes with its own security, the privacy, the knowledge. Sure. You know, what are your thoughts on that?
Right. So we operate within the parameters that the healthcare providers indicate that they have.
Okay.
And kind of with whatever consent and infrastructure they got with the patients that they're responsible for. So that means we may have different constraints, and we may have different things that kind of are allowed. And so, you know, our general approach is that kind of provider is there. You said a couple things, and you could imagine, just because, I mean, bizarrely, and there's, you know, people in the world that are bad actors and have nefarious intent on data, and healthcare providers have been held up by ransomware and stuff, which I just feel is like, you know, this is like one of the worst things you can possibly do, is shut down a healthcare provider through a ransomware.
Right?
But so we do have probably some of the best security you could imagine. We try to avoid even going over the internet and kind of do direct connections through infrastructure, such that we're not opening up things as possible. And, you know, it's probably just out of abundance of caution and prudence. I won't describe our technical architecture for how we do that, but it's, you know, we do a lot. And as you would imagine, everything's encrypted and everything else at one point, and unidirectional piping and things of that nature. So you do have to do that. I mean, it's something you have to do in this world. And it's something where we actually recognize those responsibilities in addition to this. On the other hand, data healthcare providers today have realized that, you know, and you probably know this going back from this, EMRs historically were workflow and designed to do medical coding, in the, at least in the United States. So I'll be parochially US here for a moment. So that means what they're designed to do is make sure people got paid and get people scheduled to kind of go through the workflow of a hospital system. They weren't designed to support just clinical decision making. In fact, at the time, they didn't. And most of the data models of most of the major EMRs are 40 years old plus, maybe 50 years old. So these are kind of, you know, legacy architectures that add skin the top with a little bit more contemporary flow. So that means everything we're doing is giving utility to data that wasn't originally intended in that system of record. And so that's one of the reasons why when we work with healthcare providers, the first comment we hear all the time is, you know, the first thing they say is, I can't do that with my own data. Like, I can't get that insight out of my own infrastructure and my own data. And so we provide even their data back to them in a way that has higher utility to them in terms of what's there. In our world, we, if academic researchers have bona fide questions and we have a relationship, you know, with ASCO on an ongoing basis, we always provide academic researchers data set that they need for their own publication activity, and we don't charge for that process. And again, you know, when you're doing work in healthcare, you're a member of a community. You have to be economically viable, but you're also a member of a community. So you have to act as a member of that community in addition to assuring that you also have a viable, you know, kind of long-term business model so that you can honor the commitments you're making. So,
yeah. No, I think it's really, really interesting. I think I'm keen to kind of touch on the kind of human piece here, because obviously we've got AI within healthcare is revolutionizing, like using yourself, the research piece, the workflow piece, the understanding of data piece. But there are concerns that we remove the human elements, you know, within healthcare. How do you ensure that the two work together? So obviously AI, and I think you touched on it with the research piece, but if you look to kind of frontline care, and some of those people are quite nervous around AI robotics. What are your thoughts on that? How do you ensure the two work together?
So I'll do 10 seconds here on the research one, since you noted that. So in research, we can provide a healthcare provider or research personnel tools that actually literally read the patient's record, like an expert human, taking what may be several hours of work going through kind of scores of tabs and documents and get that in front of them with very high confidence and do surveillance of who's just not responding to the current standard of care so that that research team can provide surveillance. Mm-hmm. We're not making the decision. We're not saying this patient should be put on a clinical trial, but we're making sure that all the available options, standard of care or otherwise, are placed in front of that particular research personnel. That same concept, I think, actually needs to kind of come through the rest of kind of workflows, which is you're providing a view as to is a patient likely is responding, non-responding? Is there diagnostic activity that would have changed how you would have selected a standard of care treatment and placed them on that? When they're placed on that, what's the range of different outcomes that may come forward? People are now starting to think about even creating standard of care digital twins to say, when I do this, I'm expecting this to be the following response. Am I seeing that? And if I'm not seeing that, can I understand why I'm not seeing that? And is it time to discontinue and do something else? And again, as you're kind of going through this, I think actually what's really important is that the AI solution should be capturing data, making data more present, more available, lowering the latency of all that data. So it's very, very timely. Mm. But it actually should be supporting bringing together the insights and the predictions that in turn make that clinical personnel, whatever they are, be able to work at the very top of their licensure, be a lot more precise, a lot more complete, and even be able to explain that to the patient. Explainability to that individual, but explainability over to the patient. Now, in a remote setting, you know, things like heart failure and a few others, I think you're going to find, you know, AI itself can be a very valuable companion. Again, it's not going to make the decision, but because you've got a multifaceted disease where these people have cardiovascular problems, respiratory problems, pulmonary problems, metabolic problems, confluence of the factors can lead to an acute event. And you want to avoid the acute event. I actually think that's where, you know, as we think about even elder care and kind of taking care of people, when it's placed in the right setting, it can actually improve and give clinicians more confidence and actually be part of the relationship, not getting rid of the relationship, but actually enabling a relationship in ways that they couldn't afford to do because they wouldn't have the communication infrastructure and the data infrastructure to do that. So again, maybe I'm on the more positive part, but it's actually to the clinical communities as well as the technical communities to define those use cases and advance those in the way that those characteristics kind of come together, as opposed to it's, you know, it's automatronic in some respect.
Yeah. And you touched on something earlier about obviously the amount of people, cardiologists, the radiologists, they're declining in terms of the amount of people graduating with that. And equally within the US specifically, right, there's a real staffing issue. So actually, if AI can help communicate better, you know, speed up processes quicker, then ultimately that's going to feed down to the patient, isn't it?
Absolutely. And so, Alex, for us, you know, right now, as you can imagine, These are high investments to make. You have a lot of work that you need to do to pilot things. And this is where I think our global data and AI communities are kind of coming together and understanding, like, how do we work in the right way? And again, this is new for everybody, right? So everybody needs to have open discourse as well as sort of set standards. And again, it's very difficult for regulators to come into a field where the half-life of actually large language models may be 6 to 9 months. I mean, I was actually at a meeting just a week ago, 14 new large language models from a variety of different companies all got released in the last 60 days. So you're sitting there and you're in this kind of area. So if that's the case, it's hard to regulate something that hasn't gotten to the point where it's even apparent what's regulatable and kind of going. So that actually means that we as a community need to do our own standards of conduct and actually have some measure of self-regulation or self-oversight as this gets forward. That doesn't mean external bodies won't provide that oversight, but I think it's going to be more codes of conduct and responsibility and saying, was this within the responsibilities that we've actually kind of agreed to do? It is, there's so much benefit for patients and so much benefit for new insights and so much benefit for moving new biomedical innovations forward. You don't want to slow that down.
No.
We do collectively need to, you know, exercise that responsible approach to kind of doing that.
So. Yeah, you're right. There's a lot of responsible AI, obviously the White House mandate in terms of AI generally. And I'm all for the acceleration of innovation, but not at the detriment of kind of responsible AI.
Exactly.
Final question for you before you go.
Sure.
I've really enjoyed this. Is what can we expect, obviously, within the public domain to see from CONSA over the coming months or kind of years ahead of us? Where do you see the next 12 months panning out for you guys?
Yeah. So, Alex, thank you. Really appreciate your questions, which obviously kind of reflects your own thoughtfulness about the field. So for us right now, we're kind of moving to a larger scale, as we talked about before. So this notion of, you know, we used to make insights off of hundreds of thousands of individual patient records. That's going to move even in the course of the next few months to millions of records. We used to have things where, you know, quarterly and monthly, we would begin to see different aspects. That's going to move down to weekly and daily. Mm-hmm. Some of this we'll be announcing even in first quarter. You'll see more decision augmentation solutions coming into the healthcare provider community in a very collaborative model. So both are, we have a one of our divisions called Terra Recon, which does work in radiological interpretation. It's in 2,000 hospitals today. That's going to continue to grow, and they'll do, you know, more decision augmentation. We're doing the same thing in the work we do with an entity called CancerLink that was founded by ASCO, and then it's now a Concert AI initiative where we have 100 healthcare providers, academic regional health system providers. Our first decision augmentation for precision oncology solutions are kind of going through. They've been in a pilot program. So those will kind of move off. Our research solutions are going to be adopted into the workflow of hundreds of different clinical sites in the United States. So it's about taking a lot of the work we started in that first 5 to 6 years, but now bringing it to a different scale and a different utility and kind of moving up to a higher level. We now have pharma and biopharma that are using our tools for the main part of their research infrastructure. And so we're really excited about doing that particular work. And you're going to see a lot we're doing in translational medicine. In fact, Alex, if you wanted to do a follow-up, this notion that we now have AI discovery, well, there is no then translation about how do you take that into the clinic. AI discovery is improving productivity by 30-40%. So we're taking all of our data now of human models of disease, and we can take the AI discovery, match that, and through advanced digital twin and other technologies, start changing how we do all the early stage innovations of the biomedical pipeline. That's an area that we're super excited about. Wow. It'll go from being an attrition model to really kind of an insight informed kind of model, which we think will change how that actually takes place altogether. So.
Not much then.
Not much. No. It's continuous, not discontinuous from our own history. But yeah.
No, I love that. Look, Jeff, I can't thank you enough for coming on.
Well, thank you too, Alex.
Really interesting. And I think what you guys are doing, and for people listening here, what we'll make sure is we will reference CONSA on the post. There'll obviously be, I'm assuming on your website there's some case studies. Think people can actually look around at what
there you is, doing. Actually. We can. If you want to, we have a place where we can actually post a link to your podcast too and make sure that's there. And we would love to do that with you. So I really appreciate your time too.
Well, thanks, Jeff, and have a great morning.
All the best to you too. Thank you. Care.